And hey, everybody, welcome to Pro Photo Show. It's episode 88. We got a round table for you today, the day before Thanksgiving, and we got some cool stuff to talk about. We are going to jump in here. We're live broadcasting right now over Google+, and whether you're listening to this live or whether you're tuning into the podcast feed, glad you're here. Let's jump in and get started.
Welcome to Pro Photo Show, the resource for professional and enthusiast photographers, a member of the Blueberry Network and the Tech Podcast Network. For show notes, tips, forums, and more, visit us online at profotoshow.net.
Okay, on today's panel, we have actually an all-star cast today. It's going to be a good one. We have the infamous Barry Howell. Barry, welcome.
Greetings.
Greetings to you. And we have, for the second time on Pro Photo Show, Gokhan Kukurova. Welcome, Gokhan. It's great to have you back. I'm glad you're here.
Glad to be back, Gavin. Thank you.
And brand new to Pro Photo Show, not new as a listener or as a colleague, but brand new to an actual guest spot on the round table is my friend Jason Eldridge. Hello, Jason. Good to have you here.
Howdy, folks.
It's going to be good times. I see, Jason, that you covered up the bookcase that was back behind your your webcam there with a backdrop or a sheet or something.
Are you kidding? This is my professional studio.
You're on a high rise in New York. You know, I don't know. I mean, the bookcase, the funny thing is, in the really fancy studio, they would have a sheet behind you so they could green screen you and add the bookcase to make it look like you were sitting in your office. I'm just saying.
Nice.
Okay. The video quality could be up or down sometimes on these feeds. It can be a little tricky when it's going live, but so far everybody seems to be sounding good. If you have limited bandwidth to those that are on the panel, you want to kind of watch out just a little bit, make sure you're not doing anything too bandwidth intensive that's gonna bring things down. This show is brought to you by SimFX and SimFX photo tools for Aperture and Lightroom and Photoshop, and of course the new Exposed Workshop, Change How You See Light. All that's over at SimFX.com. In fact, if you're on the live show right now at SimFX.com, you can tune in to the video feed and you can also join the chat room, SimFX.com/live, SimEffects.com/live, and you can hop into the chat room there and watch the live broadcast in real time as it's happening. So that's pretty cool. With that, let's jump right in and get started. We got a growing group in the chat room, so I'm going to keep an eye on that over there. And let's talk a bit about news. Does anybody have any exciting news tidbits they want to throw in? Frankly, I haven't seen anything terribly, incredibly awesome happen in the news, but does anybody have anything to kind of throw in there? Wow, that's a little quiet.
iPad mini. How do you like that?
Yeah.
Did you see the what was that Midnight Show or Conan making fun of iPad Mini?
No, I didn't see that.
That was so funny. And by the way, please everybody, excuse my voice. I do not have my voice.
You've been down with a cold lately?
A little bit of cold, and yesterday I was teaching at a local middle school. Trying to inspire kids, and they were very, very engaging, and they made me talk all day long.
Nice.
So
I know how that goes. I do, well, when I speak or I do square dance calling or something like that, I tend to get excited and I start, you know, really belt it out there. Maybe you have that problem too. And of course, if you do that, it takes about an hour and a half before you're like, oh, and it's pretty intense after a while. Mm-hmm. Anyways, let's in terms of news, I mean, yeah, there's a few new cameras. Nikon revealed the
D600.
D50, yeah. The D600, and people actually have that. The D5200, it looks like they announced the D5200 and 24 megapixels, 39-point AF. What is the price point of this thing? Looks like it's about $1,100. That's pretty intense camera for 39-point AF and 24 megapixels. This is, I'm looking at an Engadget article from the 6th of November. So this is a very recent one. And it's interesting, Nikon, what do you think, guys? I mean, Nikon, to me, seems to be kind of killing it lately.
Yep.
Yeah, I would agree. I've been a Nikon shooter for years, so it's nice to see this new stuff coming out. It's also difficult because I don't have enough money.
Well, that's always a problem. Yes, I can relate to that. But it seems like, and I think we've mentioned this before, that, you know, Nikon's kind of stepping ahead of Canon. Not so much that their cameras are better. I mean, they both have ups and downs in terms of advantages, but Nikon really seems to be going for the throat in terms of the value. Barry, have you worked with the D600? There's a local guy here that got one, and I kind of handled it and played with it. It seems like a really sturdy, nice body. It's big. It's bigger than I thought it would be. It's no wimp.
Yeah. You know, Dennis has one, and I know one other fellow that has one. And so far, the early read is it's pretty nice. When we were out in our inclement weather a couple weekends ago on our little retreat, we might talk about shooting. You know, Dennis opted not to bring the D600 out that day and stuck with the D700. We were in some pretty miserable shooting conditions. There seems to be some dust gathering. I think it's in the upper left-hand corner of the sensor.
This is on the D600, is that right?
D600, and yeah. It seems to be a problem that, so far, I don't think Nikon has officially acknowledged it, but it seems like the drums are beating a little bit, and I think they'll probably deal with that.
Yeah, DG Photography just mentioned that in the chat room, so it sounds like that's getting to be fairly a known issue. I always wish the lenses falling off issue on the Mark II would get that widespread that fast. The thing is, what makes them deal with it is people talking about it and it being widespread. So right. That's interesting. So there's a leak somewhere?
I tell you what, it's a heck of a camera. I see that Amazon has it for $100 off as a little Black Friday promotion, along with a free bag and I think a memory card. Nice. And I'm not sure what else.
Very cool.
So, I mean, that camera's already down to $2,000. I mean, give me a break, a full-frame 24-megapixel camera that just rocks with 1080p digital video. I mean, come here, that's crazy.
Well, yeah. And the same with this. Sorry, go ahead, Gokhan.
I couldn't even imagine using cameras like these 10 years ago. You know,
right.
You mentioned about the lens falling off on the Mark II. And a couple of months ago, my second shooter, we were at a wedding reception, and he's shooting with a 5D Mark III with a 24-70 right in front of me. He goes on one knee to take a picture of the ring bearer during the cocktail hour, and all I see is a flying 24-70.
Wow. Boom. That's not good to hear. I haven't heard a report on the Mark III because actually I got an unofficial Canon notice, kind of a personal note, that the lenses would not fall off on the Mark III. And so I don't know. I mean, there's certainly issues where it could be that, you know, that it was user error, but honestly, it's the pattern is kind of similar here. If this is what happened. So.
Yeah. The lens, I mean, the front element was just fine, but the barrel was damaged. So it was almost impossible to turn that zoom.
Yeah, that's what happens. I've done that. I've messed up. I shouldn't say wrecked because it was repairable, but it cost me. Two times on the 24-70 in particular, it seems vulnerable to those falls. If any listeners out there, if anybody's got the Mark III and has had this issue with, you know, the button is hypersensitive and the lens kind of comes loose as you're using it, this is not a new issue. When I first brought it up, gosh, in like 2009, you know, people said, oh, you're just making excuses because you dropped your lens. And then more and more people had started having the issue. So if you have this issue, shoot me an email, or better yet, go to the post. If you search for 5D Mark II lens falling off, you know, there's hundreds, I think we're up to 160 comments or something on that thread. There's a lot of discussion
that's
about this. If people are having that issue on the Mark III, report it over there, because that's I'm trying to kind of keep it all in one place, as it were.
I actually ran into a photographer at one of the at a state soccer tournament a couple weeks ago that was shooting the only Canon shooter there. Everybody else was Nikon, ironically, which was kind of fun to see. But he was shooting a 5D Mark II and a 5D Mark III, and he actually had the same thing where he had a 70-210 fall off his Mark III off an R strap.
Wow.
He just had it on an R strap. Wow. He was jogging down the field at a Vikings game, and all of a sudden, he heard somebody say, "Hey," he turned around, and there was his lens bouncing on the turf.
Wow. Yeah, that's good. That's not cool that we're hearing that on the Mark III. I'd hope they had dealt with it, because on earlier cameras, we didn't really have this problem. Something about the way the button was designed, you know, and it doesn't happen. It's one of those issues, unfortunately, that doesn't happen to everybody. I mean, that sounds terrible for me to say I want everybody's lens to fall off. But if it was a more easy to pin down issue, then Canon will be forced to address the issue. Frankly, I think it's an engineering flaw in the way their button is positioned and how sensitive it is.
But I think so too.
Yeah. We've talked about this in the past. Some people get irritated when I bring it up, but it's news. It's relevant. So if you want to learn more about it, go over to the post on Pro Photo Show. I will link that, of course, in the show notes, as I always do when this comes up over on ProPhotoShow.net. Let's see here. So yeah, I mean, kind of back onto the topic, just real quick, the D5200, I'm trying to see when this is coming out, but it looks like it's just over 1,000, 39.0 AF.
January is what I heard.
January, okay. And gosh, I mean, that's a pretty 60 frame per second video, it looks like. I'm not as up on the Nikon as some of you guys because I don't use Nikon, but dang, this looks like a pretty good camera. Weighs just over a pound, so it's a little smaller, just a single memory card, it looks like. But for over $1,000, I mean, gosh, that's quite a camera. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so other than that, I don't know. I don't think Canon's had any really exciting releases. I mean, there's always compacts and things like that coming out, but I'm not sure of anything particularly exciting. I'm kind of excited about the new GoPro Hero 3 Black Edition. It looks like they've really upped the ante in terms of video quality. And that's not really a camp photo camera per se, but it's something, you know, I do a lot of video in terms of my own projects, and that looks like a pretty sweet little beast.
Yeah, I'm about this far away from getting it.
Yeah, and I sold my Hero 2, and the money's sitting in the drawer, and then it's kind of one of those things like, oh, I need this money. So
Which drawer?
But yeah, that's the one I want. So we'll see what happens. Any other news people want to bring up? We haven't had a real lot of news, but I'm not thinking news, of anything.
I was in New York for the PDN Photo Expo, Photo Plus.
Right. How was that?
It was crowded.
It was crowded.
It was crowded. It was great.
Cool.
Couple of news. Well, I got to play with the new Leica M, and looks like high ISO issue is gone now with Leica digital cameras. And I was actually hoping to see the Sony RX1, that almost $2,700 point shoot full frame camera.
Right.
I've seen some images from it on Steve Huff's blog.
Right.
Incredible. I mean, for a small camera, not having a viewfinder is kind of a turnoff for me, but the image quality, just I can only speak for the image quality because this camera is not out yet.
No, I apologize. Which is the one that you're talking about?
RX1.
The RX1, okay.
Yeah, it's a very small camera with 35 millimeter.
Gotcha. Oh, there it is, yeah.
Zeiss lens on it, F2 cool. lens. It's beautiful. I mean, yeah, they will, of course, sell you an external viewfinder for it.
Whatever, yeah.
But, yeah, of course. But the image quality is absolutely incredible. Incredible.
Nice. That's cool. Well, do you know how it compares to like an NEX7 or something like that?
I'll tell you this much. It was as good as the D800.
Wow.
It was as good as the new Leica M at 25,000 ISO. Unbelievable.
Wow.
I mean, for a camera like that, of course, that's a first to have a full frame sensor in a
right.
camera that size.
Small. That's really
and,
cool.
And I mean, it's getting there. It's getting there.
Here's and I've brought this issue up over and over again. I don't take a camera seriously that doesn't have a viewfinder. I mean, I'm looking at specs of this, and it does look really cool. I mean, full frame and a camera this small. But are you kidding me? I mean, if I'm going to be paying pro-level money for a camera, I am a photographer. I'm not going out taking iPhone photos, you know, like, I want to be able to do the real deal, and I want a viewfinder, and it's idiocy to me. My general rule, unless somebody convinces me otherwise because the camera is so mind-bogglingly good, I will not buy a serious camera that does not have a viewfinder. The first thing I look at is, does it have a viewfinder? If it doesn't, oh, that's a non-story. And I'm not saying this isn't a story, really, because these are some pretty amazing specs. But realistically, I've basically drawn a line because every time I get a camera as a serious camera that doesn't have a viewfinder, I end up regretting it.
Enough,
and I say, you know what? Why do I have a camera with no viewfinder? This is utterly stupid. And And a viewfinder is such a basic thing. Why should I have to buy an expensive accessory and have it with me and attach it to the top so I can use a viewfinder? Exactly. Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
so
how much are you already paying for the Leica anyway?
Yeah, and well, and this and the what's the RX1 go for? I'm guessing it's above 1,000. I don't see a price.
No,
here.
it's almost 2,700.
Okay, wow. So this is this is a $2,700 camera. At least the Leica has a viewfinder. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot more than 2,700. But
no, I think you know what? I posted a video last year.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, come on, guys, somebody has to see this video and learn something from Fuji. You know, last few years, Fuji made a killing in this market,
right,
with the X100, X10, the X-Pro1, whatever. They're all beautiful cameras, especially X100, in my opinion, is a game changer.
Yeah.
And that camera will be remembered back in the, 10 years, 20 years from today, because it was the first of its kind with the hybrid viewfinder and all that,
right.
But it also had a beautiful, beautiful viewfinder.
Yeah.
Actually, I bought one last month.
Did you really?
I did, and then last week I sent it back.
You didn't like it?
I loved it, but I didn't love it as much as what I'm going to show you in a second.
What is it? Talk to,
nice.
If you talk, it'll make your image big. Here, maybe
an Exacta. I love it.
All right, Exacta, yeah. So I got plenty of cameras
nice.
Like these. And this particular camera was given to me by a good friend of mine, Jerry Alt, here in Chicago.
What is the camera, for those of us that aren't seeing that?
This is a 35mm heavy-duty German-made camera.
Nice.
You can actually take this viewfinder and then replace it with a different style.
Nice.
And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's got a 50mm f/2.8 Carl Zeiss lens on it. And
good timing.
It's a good camera to walk around with. And I spent some time in the darkroom, first time in years.
Just nice.
Recently, and printed a few, and I shoot weddings for a living, and everything I do is all digital, and I'm very, very, very happy and satisfied with what I do and what I use these days. I would not want to shoot weddings on film from start to finish anymore. For those who do, I respect them. Everybody should do what works for them, of course. But I still take one of these cameras with me once in a while and take a few frames. And after walking in New York 24 hours with the X100,
right.
I don't know if you remember, we did a 24-hour photo walk there nonstop, and it ended up being 26 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was an experience for sure, but New York is a town for that kind of stuff, And I came back, and I'm still thinking about running a roll of film in one of those old cameras. I'm like, you know what? I think that's what I'm going to do. I mean, I shoot digital for work anyway, and when I walk down the streets of Chicago downtown or one of those neighborhoods, I'm gonna stick to film a little bit, and if I really have to snap something, I still have my phone if I need to take a note.
If you just need a snapshot. No, I totally agree. I mean, this is the thing with me is, first of all, just a month or so ago, I was looking through all the kind of Micro Four Thirds and compact large sensor cameras that are serious cameras. Well, they're expensive. I was looking at the NEX7, which out of all of them is one of the few that does have a viewfinder. So it was basically the only one I considered relevant. And it's like a $1,300 camera. And I'm thinking, okay, it's great to have a good camera that I can carry with me. Well, you know what I did instead? I went and bought an Olympus 35 RC, kind of like you just did here with GoCon. It's a nice quality rangefinder. And I've held an X100. It's a cool camera, but it's kind of plasticky. It's nothing of that real rigid, solid feel like you get on the vintage rangefinders. I paid like $60 for this thing. I mean, I've got a couple rangefinders sitting around the studio here. So for really important stuff, I'll do 4x5 work. But I just keep a 35 RC, and I think I'm going to get an Olympus 35 SP, which actually has a built-in spot meter. But these things are beautiful old cameras. You can get them for like $100, $150 or less. And, you know, you look at the price of like, you know, an NEX 7, admittedly, it does a lot of other stuff. But if I just want a great compact, so if I'm out there and that radiant mm-hmm. sunset comes and I want something better than my iPhone, I need a tool that I can use. Well, at that price, I can buy two or three compact, you know, classic rangefinders that have a great lens on them, have one in every yeah. glove box. And for the $1,000 I'll save, I can buy a heck of a lot of film. And not only that, when you take one of these out, as I'm sure you know, even with 35, there's the process. You know, there's this thinking through of, you know, you're on film and it changes how mm-hmm. you think, it changes how you work.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole experience, actually. You know, I mean, I feed my family with digital, so I'm not anti-technology,
no.
but that's not going to stop me learning or dreaming of experimenting with wet plates someday. You know, right. it's the labor of love. It's the time and energy you put in. And on top of everything, you can actually use this as a self-defense tool because it's so
solid. So stinking heavy. Yeah. See, that's what I love too about the older cameras is they didn't mess around with the solidness. That was my biggest kind of, I know the X100 is as cool as it was, and a lot of people liked it, but it had some issues. But when I picked it up, my biggest frustration was, wow, I wanted this to feel like a Leica or like, you know, like a rangefinder.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an old Zeiss Icon. I think it's from the 50s in there, and it has
yeah.
it needs some cleaning and stuff, but it's just really cool. And I just came out of that's what I was doing just a minute ago, as I just pulled up a portrait out of the developer, a 4x5, a portrait I did the other day for my American Portraits collection. And it's just, mm-hmm. there's something about the film. All I have to say about film is, yeah. All right. So let's people get tired of me probably talking about film. Me and Gokhan can commiserate all night long about how great film is. Although, Barry, you just did some film recently too. You, I think
yeah.
you pulled out the old Hassie on a little trip, and
yep.
just give us the quick rundown of that.
Well, it was fun. I mean, the weather was horrible, so we didn't shoot with as many cameras as we had hoped. But here, everybody is familiar with the very famous sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and up on Lake Superior, every year on November 10th, they light the Split Rock Lighthouse for an hour and a half. Once a year, that's it. And so myself and Dennis and four other very capable, fine photographers headed northward for the weekend. We had great plan. We had 23 cameras amongst us, not counting phones, and including, I think we had 3 4x5s. I had my Hassie. One of the fellows had an RB67 along. We had some really, really cool ideas that the weather said not going to happen. We shot in basically 30-degree weather, 30 to 50 mile an hour winds off the lake, driving rain pretty much right in our face. The lake was very angry. And so it was more of, let's just see if we can all survive this and hopefully come up with some images. And we did get some really great stuff. But I was determined to shoot at least one roll of chrome on my Hasselblad, so I did so, squeezed off, you know, my full roll. All 12 shots are fantastic, and as you say, Gork, and just something about the process of grabbing a film camera, thinking mm-hmm. through every aspect, the square yeah. crop, the, you know, you have to. I was shooting Ektachrome 100, and the light was dropping so fast. It was late in the afternoon. It was absolutely the worst possible speed, but it didn't matter. I was going to get these pictures no matter what.
There you
go. But to have to think through everything with the waist level finder and everything backwards, and then to squeeze off these frames. So I did. I've been playing around with some scans off the chrome this week on a slide scanner that I have. And if I scan one of those frames at 7,200 DPI, I get about a 760 meg file.
Yeah.
And
what do you use to scan them? What scanner and what program are you using, Barry?
Well, funny story. I have an Epson. I think it's an Epson 1200U. I think is the name of the scanner. It's an old scanner
okay.
that a friend of mine gave me when he upgraded to Windows XP because there were no drivers available for it.
Okay.
And I said, hey, I'll take that thing. And so I actually am using it on a Mac G5, just, you know, and then pulling the images right
wow.
into Photoshop.
Yeah.
It's a USB scanner. That 7,200 DPI scan takes about 25 minutes. And it's got a little light box on the top of the scanner, so it's made for film or transparencies.
Mm-hmm.
I did a 9,600 DPI scan, which took an hour and a half and was 1.2 gigs, but that was kind of overkill. So
I see.
But it's just fun to play with. And
yeah, the experience is there still.
It is. Yeah, well, and the excitement for me, just the excitement of actually having.
Look at his face. Look at Barry's face.
Until I got a chance to actually go. There I was at the light table in the little photo lab, viewing with a little loop, and of course we had to clear everything off the light table. Nobody had used it, mm-hmm. I don't think, in a year, and but it was just very exciting.
It's a wonderful medium, I think more importantly, what we're getting at here is not that the world's going to switch back to film. Maybe for some things, you use film, but the point is, first of all, film for certain things has advantages, in particular, like getting great resolution and detail. Mm-hmm. But it's an experience. It's a knowledge thing. It helps you to slow down and master your craft. Because frankly, and no offense, Barry, but I think even masters like you, and I've seen this over and over again, digital has affected us. Digital has, we're so used to being able to just and take a ton of photos that sometimes we forget how to slow down a little bit. And I realize sometimes, a guy like you who does 4,000 sessions in a day, you have to be moving, you got to move along. But at the same time, knowing how to slow down and, being able to stop and think about that, I think film helps us to do that.
It looks like I'm the dissenter in the ranks. This was my backup camera for a couple of years. It's a Nikon FM2. It's really awesome to hold. I haven't snapped a single photo of this thing since 2006 when I've upgraded to digital.
Oh.
Wait, so you're saying, hold on, you're saying you're here on Pro Photo Show and you haven't done film lately?
Not a single piece of film since 2006.
Well, it's time to change that.
Guess what? Yesterday, go ahead, Jason. Go ahead. Sorry.
I did slide film. I did black and white darkroom. I did all of that. And when digital came out and I realized that, pixels are free, it was a whole new world.
Yes, but I would lay money that you'll change your mind in time because...
Well, I haven't gotten rid of the camera.
Yeah, hang on to that. Well, and here's the thing, Jason. Okay, 35, fine. I mean, I think it's cool to carry a 35, like a rangefinder. I don't carry a 35 SLR because if I'm going to carry something like that, I want it to be compact. So a 35 mm-hmm. rangefinder is really cool. But you got to get into some of the larger formats because then it's a whole different world. Now you actually have an edge on digital in terms of that detail. I've got prints in here, guys, from 4x5, and the detail compared to like a Mark II, it's night and day. I mean, you look at like the subtle detail, and there's no comparing. It's not even in the same league. Go ahead, Jared.
The problem is you have to be a really good photographer if you're going to have that kind of detail.
Well, sure, but it makes you, experimenting with it. Here's the thing. You say, okay, I'm going to work with 4x5, and you keep working and working. Then once you actually get that kind of detail, you can say, wow, I'm a really good photographer.
Wow.
let me show you a picture on my phone. It's downloading. Yesterday when I was speaking to kids at the school, there you go. All right, let's open this up. Okay, and this was the nicest classroom I've been in my entire life. For a mid-school, they had 34 IMAX, 21-inch IMAX in the classroom. And what you see here, I don't know if you can tell.
Those are newer IMAX. That's quite a. It's like a classroom filled with IMAX is what we're seeing for those that aren't watching the live feed.
What you see here, the black is not a ghost of anything or any sort. That's my 4x5 on a tripod with my changing bag on top of it. So I set it up and kids lined up to see everything upside down, and I showed them the size of the film and told them, I didn't even bring any of the digital cameras with me, and I told them, just because I'm a photographer doesn't mean I have expensive cameras. I still love these cameras, and you have to tell a story, and you do not need an expensive gear just to take a good image.
Right.
One thing I learned.
They were so thrilled.
Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead, Jason.
One thing I learned about 4x5s when we were in New Orleans is that you should just always keep one with you to set up so that you can get people to come over and talk to you.
The best branding thing ever. My profile photo is still one that actually Jason took. That's right, when we were down in New Orleans and we did the Bourbon Street walk. It was kind of a seedy place, but I'd never been there, so I didn't know that. It was a little... Anyways, so I set up the 4x5 and just a crowd, you know, just gathered around. It's great for branding. There's nothing else, I don't think. There's nothing else if you're... Particularly if you're trying to build a brand for landscapes and pictorial type stuff like I'm doing, but really anything, there's nothing else that if you're in a national park, you can set up and people are walking over to you, asking you questions and asking for business cards. You know, because if you just have a cool camera, there's a busload of people that just rolled in that have cool cameras. And if you go saying, hey, do you want my business card? They're going to be like, dude, I'm a photographer too. If you have a 4x5, they're like, there's Ansel Adams. Let's go talk to him. Okay. I'm just saying.
Speaking of Ansel Adams, as you know, we were in Yosemite with my wife a couple days this past summer. And I set up my 4x5 at the giant sequoias. These guides are walking through, and they're like, we don't see these in the park anymore.
Yeah.
People are looking at you, staring at you.
You really stand out.
What are you doing? Are you going to do a magic under that curtain?
That's exactly what you're doing. That's what it feels like, because you pull those 4x5s out of the developer, and it's like magic. You're like an alchemist. It's super cool.
Well, the flip side of that, and I have a good friend of mine who is a phenomenal 4x5 photographer. He detests the attention that it draws, because when he goes out to create images, he doesn't want anybody. He'd just as soon put police tape around himself and leave everybody as far away as possible. And it annoys him when people come up and just are Googling and giggling all over his, you know, leave me alone. I'm trying to create an image here. Stop talking to
me.
The
thing is all, you know, I'll get under the cloth and keep working as I talk if I need to. But the reality is, I'm trying to, you know, I want them to want to know who I am. And the thing is, here's the thing. You walk into a national park and start just handing out your business card saying you're a photographer when you have a DSLR around your neck, they're going to think you're some sort of psycho, you know? But I'll tell you what, you walk in there and set up a 4x5 and people walk by and you're under the cloth and you're doing your thing and it's just like, you know what I'm saying? I'm loving the sound
effects. He's prepared. You know what? Actually, we turned this into another film episode, so let's move on.
Yes, we should
move on. I agree.
We're going to come back to this on another show and have the topic of film, because we've all been tinkering with this more. Barry, on a side note, I'm using the V700 scanner real quick. And I do wet scans with it. I have a wet scan modification. It is faster, too. That older scanner, I think you're suffering a little there, because I can scan a 15,000 pixel 4x5 negative in about 5 minutes or so. But we'll come back to this.
I'll FedEx you my film, and you can scan it for me.
send them over to Gavin.
Anyways, let's get into our topic of the day. And our topic of the day is not so distant from film, but it doesn't just encompass film. We're going to do presentation today. I want to talk about what people are doing with presentation, how we print and display images and make them look their best on walls. A digital file is great, but it's the finished product that counts. And that's what I want to talk about today. Now, we're not going to go on for too long about this. We're going to do this. Then we're going to go into a couple of fun lightning rounds and just kind of open it up a little bit. And then we'll wrap up this Thanksgiving Eve with some picks of the week and send everybody out to go see their family. So let's talk about presentation. I'm working on a series of articles on Pro Photo Show dealing with presentation and how I deal with printing and stuff like that. So I'll kind of spread those out on the Twitter and things like that as they come along. But I just wanted to ask kind of all of you, I'm a huge proponent. First of all, I'm a proponent of slowing down in quality and getting the one image instead of the 1,000 images, as you guys well know. But the other thing that I'm equally passionate about is presentation, because I think in a world where there's tons of photos being made, I mean, countless photos, tons of competition, if I can get people here in my studio, they get it. They see these big prints on my walls and they get it. Whatever your presentation approach is, I think there's very little thought these days comparative to what we should be going into presentation. I've spent years now refining everything from, you know, how and where I sign my prints to how I package them. I'm getting to the point where I have so much consistency, particularly with my pictorial work, that I'm feeling comfortable with, okay, now I can build a brand on this. Now, this is my product. This is what I do, and this is how I do it. So
I've been talking. We're going to come back to me, but I'm going to start by going through you guys, and then we're going to come back. And this isn't going to be officially a lightning round. We can take a couple minutes, but let's not go on forever about it. And let's just talk about how are you presenting? You know, how are you printing? Maybe you're not printing as much as you should be, and you need to think about this more. And I think that could be said probably for a lot of us. So who wants to go first? Who wants to start off the topic on presentation today?
I'll jump in.
Yeah, go, Barry.
First thing, I'm going to put in just a little bit of a break from the standpoint that I think presentation is a twofold, it's a two-pronged thing. First of all, it's how do we present images? How are they displayed in our places of business? If we have studios, where are they? What do they look like? Are they lit properly? Are they framed well? That's one topic. The other topic is sometimes I think we strangle ourselves with how we think a portrait needs to be finished before it's hanging in a customer's home, when in reality, we don't really necessarily get to control that entire loop. And as evidenced by a recent customer I'm working with who wants to order a, it's going to probably be a 40 by 60 inch family portrait, and the file's great and it's gonna print fine and I have no worries about that. And I'm talking with them about framing, and suddenly I get this, oh, no, we're not gonna spend a lot of money on a frame. Because you know the print's going to be so expensive and everything else, we just can't really afford to do that. Maybe we'll frame it more. We'll frame it nicer at some point down the road.
This and
you know, my
happens.
Head just hits the table because exactly, it's never going to happen. But they've got coupons, and Michaels has some deal on framing, and it's a little irritating because I you know what ultimately may happen is I'll produce a beautiful print. It'll be lovely. It'll probably be a big canvas print. They'll slap a dirt cheap frame on it. And it'll be hanging on their wall, and unless I probably want to buy the frame for them, what do you do with that? So that's my sort of frustration with this topic a little bit. Okay. And I run a fairly high volume, eclectic studio where we do seniors and some families and kids and weddings and sports teams and deal with several area high schools, and basically we do all of it with two of us. There full time.
Right.
So we are not exactly sitting around having wine and cheese parties with all our clients for hours on end, as much, you know, fun as that would be. Mm-hmm. So I have to kind of walk that line of how we present that. It's been almost 2 years now, I guess 2 years that we've been projecting everything in terms of the portrait and family work, which has been helpful. It has helped us sell more wall portraits, but still not nearly as enough. But
you still haven't been to Wall Portrait Conference yet. I just have to point that out. I've been trying to
Gavin,
get you to come.
I tell you, when you stop having them in the busiest season of my year, you know, we can talk about it.
What are you saying? You need to make money?
Actually, that is what I'm saying. I haven't really spent a lot of time. I do a lot of reading. I've been listening to Gavin and am curious about some of the new mounting techniques that a number of people are starting to pursue. What we've found is that as we've been pushing canvases really hard this last year, and probably 2/3 of our wall portrait sales are now canvas, and I would say over half those people want nothing to do with a mat or frame of any kind. They just want to slap that baby up on their wall, and I can't necessarily argue with it. It's not a bad look. So our canvas prints, do they have to be framed? My opinion would be no. Can they be framed? Sure. And
well, that's one of the nice things I think about a canvas, Barry, is that you can, while I'm a big proponent of a frame, if you do a canvas, it is mounted, prepped, and ready to hang, and you can at least get a great portrait on their wall, and maybe they genuinely will frame it down the road, because usually when you get a larger print, they have to get into a custom frame, and at that point, it's going to be halfway decent, but it's an end road, because at least you got a great piece of art on their wall.
True. So, I don't know, what is somebody else doing with it? I haven't really...
Barry, have you thought of, instead of giving the client the freedom to go and get a cheapo frame for your beautiful piece of art, have you thought of a networking and kind of like working together with a local frame shop?
I've actually tried that twice in the last 15 years. Uh-huh. And both times it went fine for about 6 months. unfortunately, one of those frame shops now does photography as well. And the other one is basically out of business or almost out of business.
So the frame shop decided to expand a little bit and then go into photography.
They weren't expanding. You know, the word we use, they were kind of trying to be diversifying themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the day, I used to go to the frame shop. I don't know if they're still there. What part of town do you live?
Well, in the northeastern suburb, TC Molding is where I get all my framing.
Okay, I'm familiar with them. There was a frame shop right by Plymouth Road and Minnetonka Boulevard.
Hmm.
Okay, I don't know if they are still there, but they're awesome people, great work, and what we did was just like if you. Say the frame is X amount of money, and if you go and get your frame at this shop, you get this much discount so on. But it worked just fine. I guess, you know, not everything will work for everybody.
Right.
And canvases are great, easy to handle. They handle dust and humidity very good.
Are you doing much framing now?
No. Mostly canvas and albums. Albums are great, and but last month at the Photo Plus, I got a chance to actually handle and experience the wood snap. Have you heard of them?
Yes.
Nope.
Yeah. So it's something I'm thinking about looking into and maybe get one for my house. And
those are basically a print on a piece of wood. Let's clarify here. Remember, there's people listening that don't understand what's being seen, said here.
Yeah, and it is
interesting.
Yeah, you know, the concept is going to change. One product will become more popular over the years, and one will go down. Just like fashion, it's going to rotate. So people or in companies are going to try to come up with something new, new frames, new canvases, this and that. The goal should be, no matter what you do, you need to focus on selling a large print, but not just large print. If I can sit down and explain the meaning of that piece, if I can bring them to that same mindset, if I can have them understand what that is, either it's a print or a canvas, but I've got to get something on the wall. That's very important. Lately, I've been using the Bay Photo for canvases.
Mm-hmm.
The print quality, the build quality, the packaging is incredible. So colors, just fine. I've been very happy with them.
So what are you, mostly you're doing inkjet canvas then, am I understanding that correctly?
Correct.
Okay. Now, when you sell, I'm going to try and drill down to a little more detail here, because I want to cover this in depth. If you're selling mm-hmm. them prints then, if they don't buy a canvas, do you mount your prints, or do you just hand them a loose print and they walk out the door, or how do you handle that?
No, actually everything above, because first of all, we don't even offer 4x6s on stuff like that.
Sure.
8x10 is going to be the smallest they can purchase. And the thing is, I'm sure you heard of Joe Busink, the famous wedding photographer. Once he said, do what you do best, delegate the rest. Okay. So I'll take that to a point. Meaning, I want to book, shoot, and my editing, to a degree, I do it, and I have other people do the rest. Same thing
so
with the album.
So you outsource whatever you can. Then.
Yeah, outsource it. So the thing is, people who will go out of business are going to be mostly people who are not going to spend enough time to go get the next customer. So my approach to that is I need to have more time, more freedom to go out and book that next client. And I'm thankful and blessed that today I booked my very first 2014 wedding.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. That's
2014.
Super. That's a ways out.
Almost 2 years now. So the thing is, if the canvas is coming from Bay Photo,
right.
So the sizes, everything is all set. They can go on the Smug Mug and then purchase it. They will already be familiar with the canvas quality before they even sign a contract, because they get to see the albums, they get to see the canvases, so they already know what's going to come. And before they even hold it in their hands, it's going to come to me. It's not going to be shipped to their address.
No, you want to control that product and make sure they're getting something special.
You don't want to give out all the control. So even though they've been so accurate, so on time with all the orders and the color corrections and calibration and all that, I still need to see the product. I need to be the one who is giving that product to the client.
Right.
Because I am the one who captured that image. I was there.
Sure.
So when they hold that, I need to be in that environment. I need to be in that room with them.
You're making it personal.
Exactly. That's the whole thing.
Right. Okay, cool. Yeah, no, and the personal touch, I mean, is super important. Presentation is a little more the aesthetic side, but it's certainly rounded off by how, you know, it carries through to right down to how we present it to them, how we give it to them, how we build that value, really.
Mm-hmm.
Jason, let's move on to you. What do you have? First of all, Jason, I didn't give you a proper introduction. I apologize. We kind of got jumping in. Go ahead and give us your 60-second bio there and just tell us, you know, where you're from and where you're at. Everybody else here on the panel has been on before, but this is your first official time on the show. Give us that, and then we'll hear from you about how you do presentation.
All right. Well, I live currently just south of Miami in Homestead, Florida. I grew up originally in East Tennessee, and that's where I started my photography there in 94. Got my first real camera, did some wet darkroom stuff like that. Didn't get really serious, I guess, until 2001. I started into slide film, moved on from there. I moved from the majestic mountains of East Tennessee to the flat, nasty swamps of South Florida. I wouldn't say nasty, but, well, they're kind of nasty, so we'll go with that. No rolling hills here, obviously. So I just sort of sat around, didn't do anything, kind of grumpy because I lost my mountains. Then went into the city, started doing some city photographs, and those turned out really nice and really got back into it. About 2008, I guess, is when I really, really got back in. And I moved on to people because I didn't have all the nature that I enjoyed shooting.
Right.
So I needed something different. I got into people, and strangely, I said I would never like it, and I enjoy it quite a bit.
Right.
So that's where I've been. I do this as on the side. I am not a full-time professional. I would like to say that I'm semi-professional, just in my nature. So
sure. Cool. Right. So first of all, thank you. That's exactly what we needed. What do you feel about presentation? What are you doing for presentation, and what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I've come very, very far. I'll just start with that. When I started, the idea was I'll take a bunch of pictures. When I started in digital, we'll go that way, once people were involved, I'll just take a bunch of pictures, and they'll sit on my hard drive forever. You know, I'll occasionally show someone when they come over. I didn't even have a website, nowhere to put it, anything like that. So then I got a Smug Mug website, and I just...
Right.
I would do a little shoot for somebody, and I would throw it up there and tell them, yeah, you can go order your prints. It's really cool, this new technology we have. You go do everything yourself, and you don't have to deal with me anymore. So I went from that. Then I started feeling the need to get a little bit more personal. And in fact, one of my logo says artistic and personal. Those are the two words I like to use to define the business. The personal part really started getting to me. So I didn't want the clients to go on and just order everything themselves. I wanted to be able to bring it in and then look at it before I presented it to them.
Right.
So it was more of a personal issue. But as far as hanging it on the wall, again, I started really, really low. I had a couple of gallery showings here in Miami. In the very first one, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't get any advice from anybody, and I just bought plain mats and hung them on the wall. So you've got images in mats hanging on the wall, no frames, no nothing. And
right,
it was pretty sad. But now I've moved on a little bit. I have some difficulty printing. I use Bayphoto. They do a great job, but I'll get a print, and I've got a closet full of prints right now waiting to go on my wall. And I can't seem to get myself to do it because I always feel like I'm being vain.
Oh, I have no problem.
I'm great. I'm awesome.
Very cool.
All right, Gavin, what do you have for us here? I'm afraid to ask.
I'm going to yodel. No.
Please, no.
Oh, come on. Come on. Okay. I'm going to try and not keep it too long because I could literally talk for about 24 hours on presentation.
And I won't let you.
Yeah, you won't let me, I know. But I still honestly think we need to sit down all individually and take this further. I think that it's relevant because there's so much images being made. There's so much work being done that nothing really stands out. Frankly, I see these new gadgets, if we want to call them that, gimmicks, I think would be a more proper word. You know, whatever new stuff the lab is peddling this week, mm-hmm. that's you know, only $29 and you can sell it for $600, you know. If I'm going to sell a product, and I'm going to say, hey, I want you to buy fine furniture from me, because that's really what we're selling when we put a wall portrait, a quality wall portrait on somebody's wall. If I'm going to sell a piece of furniture, I'm not going to go out and buy the cheapest gallery wrap, i.e., you know, the cheapest wood I can find. That's not to say that these things that labs are coming out aren't interesting sometimes, that they don't have their place. That's not to say that these labs aren't producing any quality material. I'm not trying to knock anybody in particular. It's just I see an industry right now where most of the time people's idea of presentation is, you know, here's what I can get easily right now. Right. And I think that's the wrong approach in a world where everyone else is making the same thing. Here's my thought on a gallery wrap. And admittedly, I tend to take a little bit of a traditionalist approach to presentation because I look around, and some of this does come from my studying under Kim Whitmire. Kim Whitmire talks about those inkjet gallery wraps, and he says, well, see if I can get his voice. He says, well, those are okay. Yeah, I mean, they're fine. Everybody has a different approach. But to me, they feel kind of like placemats. And I think that's the perfect example of what an inkjet gallery wrap feels like. For heaven's sake, you can go to Walmart and Costco, you know, and get an inkjet gallery wrap for $29. Now, am I saying that because people are selling inkjet gallery wraps that they're bad photographers somehow? No, I'm just saying, What are we trying to produce, and how much do we want it to stand out? So as I'm kind of ranting here, let me actually talk about what I do a little bit. In terms of presentation, I do, first of all, mostly large prints. You know, if somebody wants to order their 5x7s and 8x10s for grandma, that's fine. But my main goal is to sell a wall portrait with each session I do, or to sell wall portraits of my pictorials. And I do both those things. Usually, I start at 24 inches. So, for example, if you were to look at my price list, I start at 24-inch wall portraits. Anything underneath a 24-inch is affectionately termed a gift portrait. That means it's for grandma. The 24-inch is the wall portrait, and I sell it that way, not in the sense of shoving it down their throat, but from the moment they walk in the door, that's all they see. Presentation starts with what you do with your own work. Presentation starts with the moment you pick up the phone and talk to a client and the moment they walk in the door. When people walk into my studio, they see... Well, hang on, let me show you. For those of you that are on, see if I can fit it here. You know, they see these. And if I, it won't fit. Let me turn it sideways. This is what I want them to see. You know, when I better get back here. This is going to destroy my audio quality if I'm standing over there. What I'm getting at is, I have agonized for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years now about presentation and just been experimenting and I've been up at 1 a.m. scouring through old articles trying to find out, okay, how did Ansel sign his prints? How do galleries consider acceptable in the way we do limited editions? And that's not to say I'm the only one doing this. I just think whatever approach we're taking, you know, I'm taking that fine art kind of approach. I want something special for people. Whatever approach we're taking, I think we need to think about that. In my case, I'm doing a lot of canvas. Not all canvas, but a lot of canvas. So basically what I'm doing, and let me switch the camera around here just a second, if I can see if I can pop it off here and just kind of point it around the studio a little bit. It's probably terrible. There's my printer over there. So I'm printing almost everything in-house on an 8300. All right. Now, if you look around the studio in this horrible quality, and you see that's what I'm showing around here, too. I have mostly pictorials right now, but not entirely. And for those of you that are not on the on the video feed, this isn't super relevant, but what I'm doing with the camera is just pointing it around the studio. Now, bottom line here, I'm doing making my own prints. Then I'm coming back and either A, canvassing, which is what I do with a lot of them. And when I say canvassing, I'm not printing an inkjet print. This is my little bit of a peeve against inkjet prints, is after I found out about traditional bonded prints, which I'm sure, you know, the old timers and, you know, guys like you, Barry, I know that, you know, back in the day, this is what you had for canvas. So I'm sure you're fully familiar with this stuff. But a bonded canvas print, they take a print, they strip the paper off the back of the print. And so in the old days, what it would have left was the emulsion. If I'm doing an inkjet print, it's just leaving a thinner, you know, the thinner resin coat part of the paper. And then they bond that, in this case, to a canvas. Now, who I use is canvasmount.com for this, and they do a phenomenal job. I've never seen a traditional canvas that's in the same league. Now, there are some of the labs and stuff that offer this service. I believe ACI does. I believe H&H Color Lab does some of this traditional canvas stuff. Each place does it a little bit differently. Canvas Mount, you actually send them the print. They're not a print service. You send them the print like in a tube. They handwork this canvas, and there's a phenomenal video on their site. I'm going to link that in the show notes, and just check out this video. That's the best way to understand how I approach the canvas side of it. And they just do these beautiful canvases, and then they canvas them on this really heavy canvas and then put four or five coats of lacquer on them. My canvases, when they're done, and this is what I tell my clients, I say, you can clean it with Windex. That's how durable it is. And so what I'm getting at is, yes, the canvas looks good, but it's also part of that presentation is that they can't get this at Costco. So that's huge for me. Go ahead. You guys are welcome to interrupt a little.
Yeah, you just nailed it there, because just because you have a printer doesn't mean the final product will look good or will last long enough. You know, your color calibration, the inks you're using,
everything matters.
And like when it comes to like canvases we're talking about, you know, a Gicle print on a canvas, very solid mount, looks a lot different than a canvas they can get at a Wolf Camera or a Costco.
Right, right.
So it's your job, my job, to explain that and educate that client on what's being invested on.
Right, you want to show that value, that you're not just...
Exactly.
And what I see a lot of times is people just getting whatever the latest cheap thing the lab offers, and that's their presentation. You know what I mean?
Because, I mean, you have to believe in your product,
exactly.
Number one. And if you don't believe in it, how are you going to make other people believe it? Number two, you should be able to hang that on your wall,
right,
before you can even sell it.
Right. You can't sell what you don't show.
No.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's also the, you know, there's also the reality of the market, and you can theorize all day long about what you want to sell. And
absolutely,
you can try to sell what you think you want to sell.
Mm-hmm,
at
mm-hmm.
some point, you have to listen to your client base and get a feel for if they're willing to pay for it. And when
mm-hmm.
you find that they are, great. But when they're not, there's no sense to fight it. And
mm-hmm.
not that you want to just necessarily drop to a lesser quality product. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I've had some interesting conversations in recent months with a couple of photographers who at the moment are doing virtually no sessions, aren't really dealing with customers. They know what they want to do. One of them wants to do nothing but families and sell nothing but ginormous prints and wants to basically never touch a camera without about $5,000 paid up front to do it. Hey, it's a great business model. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never fly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, at this point, you're never going to get, you know, point being, you have to be logical and you have to fit within the realm of
your market,
of your market and your client base, and you know, and you know, I have a studio that's been in business now 30 years, and so we have you know, we have sort of some expectations about where we fit in the home market sector. We've moved it quite a bit in the last you know, 17 years or whatever it's been since I have owned the company, but we still have to be respectful of reality, I guess. So,
well, we have to be, yeah. There's certainly reality. It depends on, you know, your business model and your approach. And, you know, like Barry, I understand you have volume going through and you have to maintain a certain level. You know, everybody's not going to spend $5,000. On the other hand, and we're getting kind of into marketing here, so I should continue. On the other hand, though, people do tend to buy what you believe in and what you sell to a point. You have to show them the value, and it's not always as much as you want it to be. But for example, so I have these big canvases. Those are what I want to sell, okay? Whether it's a pictorial or a portrait. I print these things over here. I send them off to have canvas. Alternately, I'm going to try and move quickly here. I have a mounting press in the other room. Gokhan, you mentioned people, you know, we get all these prints and pretty soon we're sitting on a bunch of prints, but prints don't mean anything unless we've actually presented them and, you know, have them hanging on a wall.
Exactly.
The mounting press has helped with a lot with that. I picked up a 40-inch dry mount press off of Craigslist and I paid about $300 for it. I spent a couple hundred dollars more to get the 220 plug in where I needed it and get everything up and running. So there's an investment there, yes, but now I can walk in there. I got these big 40-inch sheets of material and I can mount these prints. So if I'm not canvassing them, I never sell a wall print that's not mounted. It's either canvassed. I sometimes do metal, which obviously I can't print those myself. I send those out to Image Wizards. And there's some other companies like Bay that do nice work on the metal. Or I do a mounted print. And then if it's an inexpensive print, it might just be packaged and it's designed to go under glass. If it's a limited edition or a portrait for somebody or something like that that's mounted, it'll also have coats of lacquer and things like that because inkjet prints tend to be very delicate. Barry, coming back to what you were saying, I agree largely. We approach it a little bit differently, although you certainly do much more volume than I do. And I kind of realized that too. Particularly, a perfect example of this is my pictorial work. Because what I wanted to be selling was these big canvases like I showed here. I wanted to be selling these limited edition, you know, 50, 60, 70 inch canvases for $2,000. Well, I still do. And those are a great thing to show people, a great way to impress people, and a great thing to put in a gallery. But what I realized, and Barry, you probably remember me talking to you about this 8 months ago, I said, you know what, I'm going to have to be a little more realistic. I have to have a product that is a little more attainable. And that there is these right here. So here is what, for those that aren't seeing, this is a 24-inch mounted print. So this is dry mounted, and we have a process. My point, I guess, in the whole presentation discussion is think about what your process. Every one of these is done very succinctly, and it's done exactly the same. They're all printed 24-inch with a border, so the actual image is slightly less than 24 inches. This is a workflow issue, and it's an archival issue. It's a workflow issue because I can print directly from 24-inch paper and make these prints easy, and I can make them cheap. It's an issue of presentation because these prints don't come in a frame. When they're sitting on a store shelf, having that 1/8-inch white key line around makes them a little bit more of a presentation. It's also an archival issue because as prints age, material ages from the outside in. This gives me a slight buffer if the things start to yellow or something gets a little wet or something like that before the print is damaged. This 1/8-inch border is designed to be covered when it goes into a frame. This product in-house, I'm printing a 24-inch print on the 8300. I'm mounting it on roughly 1/8-inch dry mount board, recycled dry mount board that I get from Blick Art Supply. Dry mounted, packaged, labeled, ready to go. This thing is sturdy. I can take this into a gift shop and say, hey, do you want these? This cost me about $10 to produce. These sell for $99 is what I the price tag I put on these. And there's some flexibility if I'm doing a consignment or something like that. Mm-hmm. My point being that we can think about presentation and refine a process without always being high end. That said, I've still put a lot of thought into this. You know, every one of these, for example, is initialed. It's not signed because I want there to be a difference between my higher-end limited editions and my little open editions here. So these aren't numbered. They are hand-initial, which means I've inspected them. I've handled them. I know what's going on with it. At the same time, there's a dividing line between those and my larger, more expensive prints, which are significantly more money. So I've agonized about all this, and I'm not saying everybody's going to do it the same way as I am, but I think that thinking about what we want to sell and then also thinking about, you know, coming back to Barry, Barry's pretty grounded in reality on this stuff and thinking about how we can then take that approach to selling and make a product that's quality, but that's versatile in terms of who we can sell it to. I guess that's my goal, is to have refinement in the presentation, to also have flexibility. I'm gradually starting to sell these. It's very hard to sell pictorials, especially in an economy like this, but I've got a consistent product that I can put in people's hands. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and I guess the point I would wrap up this conversation with is, you know, branding, and we know that's important. I have a friend of mine who came back from a seminar where the whole workshop was on branding and signing or putting a logo on every print that goes out of your studio, and he was a wedding portrait guy. So when he came back, he tried it, and he got quite a bit of pushback right away from his customers who weren't very happy that his logo was slapped on everything that was coming out the door. So what he did then, it was pretty clever, he came up with a new price list where he simply charged more for prints without his logo. And 90% of his customers paid more to not have his signature or logo anywhere on the print.
Okay, I want to clarify something, though. This was a logo, not a signature. The two are very different, and I
have
never...
Well, his logo was his signature.
Okay, but that's not a signature. A logo is a logo, and a signature is a signature.
Okay, fair enough.
And signing a print, you know, the best artists throughout history have signatures on their prints. If somebody buys a wall print, okay, if they buy an 8x10, I have my signature as a digital file, and it's overlaid on the print because, you know, it's exported when I export from Lightroom. If I sell even one of these, well, this is an initial... my open editions are, but if I sell somebody a custom portrait, like a wall portrait, even if it's a 24-inch, it is hand-signed, and that's not optional. I've never once had somebody complain about it. It's a very classy signature, and there's an article on Pro Photo Show about all my signatures and stuff that I'll link in the show notes. My point being that this comes down to thinking about presentation. I think it's crazy to send a piece of art or a portrait out your door without your name on it. Because when they put that on your wall, that is free marketing. People are going to come in. And one of the first things I do when I look at a piece of art is I look down and I look down in the corner and I try and see, I want to know who made it, you know, if it's a painting or whatever. So the point is not to not use a signature. This is part of the presentation too. You know, part of your presentation planning might be agonizing over how your signature is going to look. All this stuff is relevant. We're selling ourselves as artists. We need to have a plan.
But Gavin, you're also operating under an assumption that everybody is, you are Gavin Syme. You can sign at Gavin Syme all day long. Look around at how many photographers have photography businesses that aren't their name. Look at mine, for example. It's Picture Place. That's not a name. That's a company name. I know a lot of photographers who, you know, their name might be John Smith, but their photography is, you know, Candlelight Love Images or whatever.
Sure, but your signature is always
some
your signature.
Sort of,
but Gavin, why would I want to sign? Why would somebody want a portrait with my name on it? That has nothing to do with my business. I mean, it does because I'm the business. But
exactly.
You know, they have to find. Well, but that's my problem. So do I change the name of my company so that I can sign prints?
You can already sign prints.
If I sign Barry Howell on all the prints that go out the door, they didn't. Well, I mean, they know me because they get to deal with me, but they deal with my company on a larger scale. Because I'm not just Barry Howell Photography. I have an organization and I have lots of things. So
right,
that's where this gets a little sticky.
They can get confusing. But I went through that a couple of years ago and I ended up putting my first name on the business. And as you can read on the screen, it's not the easiest name or last name to say or remember. Especially my last name, people butcher it all the time. I don't even go there. When I walk into a bride's house on a Saturday morning, I introduce myself, and here's what I say. Hey, my name is Gokhan. They look at me like, huh? And I say, Gokhan, Gokhan, go. And then they remember. All day long, they call me with my name right away. As Gavin said, some sort of identification must be on the work. But of course, the branding starts, in my opinion, before you even click the shutter.
Sure.
So how you put that business name or your personal name, whichever the name your customers know you with, has to be, in my opinion again, has to be on your final product. But of course, it needs to be done tastefully. Can you imagine Picasso putting his name on in the middle of his painting so big?
And that's the whole...
It can be overdone, especially with these new tools, like lets you put your name or copyright sign all over the place.
It's just terrible. It destroys the presentation.
It definitely needs to be minimalistic, but needs to be on there. It needs to be tasteful, absolutely.
And the bottom line is, I mean, that's the whole point of the topic. Not that everybody's going to do it the same. Although Barry, I think your issue is in part at least non-existent. You know, you're Barry Howell. You are the guy that takes the photos at Picture Place. I would absolutely sign it, Barry Howell. I kind of wish my name had an H in it because I'm thinking like you can kind of. I mean, I already know what the H looks like in my mind. So I don't know. We've all seen, you know, like, you know, even like Olin Mills, you know, cheap Kmart portraits, they would have the little Olin Mills. They had the business name on there. And frankly, you didn't complain because it looked classy. It was a little foil stamp or whatever it was. I'm a firm believer in hand signing the better prints, the more significant prints. But I've seen different ways of doing it. For example, Ken Whitmire signs his wall portraits. He doesn't sign them Ken Whitmire. He signs them Whitmire and Associates, you know, 2010. So it's kind of this big and there's a lot, but it's a scripty, handwritten kind of thing and it looks beautiful. I guess the point being that that's the whole goal of us challenging each other on presentation. How are you going to do it? If you put a logo, and I've done this, this is, you know, the thing you mentioned earlier, putting the big old logo on the front of the image. The first time I did that, somebody said, well, there's this big green logo on our portraits. And I, you know, that was a quick realization of, okay, this doesn't work. So everything for me, and I agonized about this of what exactly to do, but consistently now one way or the other is signature or initial. And then the back of my prints are usually stamped with more information about my business. So then if they, you know, if somebody really wants to say, okay, where do I find this guy? They can look at the back of the print and you know, see my info on the back of my print. I think the reality is individually we have to determine how we want to do it, but there's no good reason not to sign a print. Unless it's, you know, if it's being used for commercial or for a billboard or something, that might be one thing, but they're paying accordingly for that, you know what I mean? Jason, you've been quiet for a while. Do you have anything to add to this?
Well, personally, I don't have a studio, so I don't have any place that I display my work or bring clients into. Usually I meet them somewhere to discuss the details of what we're going to be doing. So I don't have any place that I show this. I don't typically sign the prints. That's something that I've considered in the past, but I was always afraid of just, you know, signing my name across it and just getting the look from them.
I'll tell you what. Now, the logo thing is another story. I have never ever had one complaint about my hand signing or initially my prints. And in fact, I sell that. I mean, I promote that. It's a value. I say, now when you get a wall portrait, these come hand signed and with a certificate of authenticity. Yeah. I'm not offering it as an option. It is a feature in the work that I do that this is artistic work that's been presented this way. Jason, I just want to add something real quick and then I'll let you go, whoever's talking here, go. You mentioned that you meet with people in person. One thing I'm working on to take to galleries, and I've already got quotes and stuff from the company, is there's places that make these custom-made boxes, these custom folio boxes that are made out of, like, linen, okay? So one thing that I'm looking at is, I think Folio Box is the name of one of the ones I was working with. In any case, what they're going to make for me is a 24-inch square box that's about 2 inches deep and the lid open. So we're talking about a great big box. What I'm going to have is 24-inch square mounted prints. So there's going to be white space. I'm going to use it like a mat. The prints are going to be, you know, like 18, and then the rest is going to be white. They're all going to be put on this square thing. So this box, you're going to open up this box. It's going to have a stack of 24-inch squares, all of which have my pictorial work, and I intend to make one for portraits as well for on-the-go presentation because I immediately want them thinking about the quality of my prints. These are all going to be mounted, nicely presented. You're going to open the box. There's going to be a pair of linen gloves lying there for each, you know, and then you can put these gloves on, and here's these prints, and I'm going to hand sign all those too. So what you can do is, even though they're not hanging on the wall, you've built a print presentation, and you have an approach. Now, maybe your approach will be different than mine, but my goal is to sell them a wall portrait. So what am I going to do? Well, I'm not going to take an iPad in. I'm going to take a big Hirkin box and say, these are the little versions of my wall portraits, and this is my current folio presentation. So that's, I just wanted to throw that out there. I'll show you guys that once I get it finished, but it's just something to think about. Sorry, somebody
else
is trying to.
Well, and I think we could beat this thing to death, but
I know.
You know, the reality is that I do think that for the landscape work, and I'm finding that, and I'm starting to do a little bit more of that type of work for fun and something that, you know, I can begin marketing, and I'm going to basically use it as an added value lever to some of the other work that I do with, you know, with the regular studio stuff. But I think I'm a bigger fan of the branding and the signature of, in that case, an artist doing a beautiful, you know, pictorial in your case, and some of the stuff that you did on your 4 month little trip last year. You got some spectacular images. That seems to me to be far more comfortable and the absolute best place to really brand and sign away. You know, the portrait world, you just have to decide how far down do you drill it. Are you going to be, are you signing 5x7s? Are you signing wallets? Are you signing, you know, it's like I could slap my signature across every wallet, but I'd get writer's cramp. So,
well, I have a very specific set of rules though. Anything under anything that's not the, the smaller stuff is audit the same signature, but it's digitally overlaid. So it looks a little different. It's not, yeah, it's no, more perfect. And I'll be honest, I don't differentiate. The more I'm doing, like, here's my wall portraits, here's my pictorials, I'm starting to have almost complete consistency in how I handle them, and I take the same approach. Sorry, Gokhan, you were trying to talk. I keep interrupting.
No, I mean, I've been doing portraits. I've done a lot of, even though 99.9% of what I do is weddings, but I've done family portraits and kids and all that along the way. And, excuse me. Even with the family portraits, I think when I sit down with them, we have to brainwash them.
I call that building value.
We have to let them know you're not going to Kmart for your portraits.
Right.
And please excuse my voice, but it's not that. If you want Kmart portraits, you go to Kmart. You know where it is.
Everybody's okay. Not our client.
Exactly. Right. So the thing is, if this person coming to me for their family portraits, before even we go on the picture taking, we need to get to know them, as we need to let them give them some chance to get to know me. So if they believe that they're not just getting their picture taken, they're going to really, really appreciate that signature, that personal touch.
They're buying your board.
Exactly. You know, like people go, and this is kind of funny, and if you've done it, please don't get offended. I laugh so hard when I see people run after athletes and golf players and then turn their backs and have their t-shirts signed. You know, if they can put those signatures on the t-shirts, why can I as an artist, not just a photographer, as an artist,
exactly, and you totally
as a creative person with a vision.
People pay extra for their shirts that have the huge logo of the company right across the middle of it, and I can't sign my portraits. I'm sorry, that's not happening.
I'm coming from a country, the soccer is everything. Okay, you pay over $1,000 for a soccer ball that's signed by a famous soccer player.
Right.
Okay. So why is that? Because it makes it especially adds a value. Again, I don't want to repeat myself, but with the family portraits too, as long as that signature is big enough to identify the artist.
Right. It doesn't have to be
what I'm saying, the artist, exactly. Big enough to identify the artist, located tastefully, but not take attention from the work itself.
Right.
I think it's a must have.
It's perfectly appropriate, and I agree that it's a must have. I think not signing your work is basically the equivalent. You know, we look at all these other things that are signed and branded. Not signing your work is like saying I haven't done the homework and I'm not confident enough in what I'm selling to put my name behind it. When I sign that print, everybody's going to know Gavin made it, and that's a good thing. I want them to know that because I. Mm-hmm. Put value on that. It's kind to me, and I realize, you know, maybe I'm getting subconscious here, but it's like saying I don't value my work enough to put my name on it because everybody else does. When you buy, if you buy a Ferrari, how do you, you know, do you think, would you be happy if they said, oh, let's just pop the logo off the front, you know, here, give us the money. You don't want this Ferrari logo on the front of your car. Absolutely, you want the logo. The brand
is relevant.
To buy that car for that logo.
That's right. Some people take the logo and stick it on their Toyota so it looks cooler. Anyways, I mean, we've gone over a lot of this, but we've kind of beaten this to death, but all this presentation stuff, I mean, we've had some good dialogue here. This stuff's important. And go ahead.
Let me add one more thing, because I think it's needed to be said. Not everybody who doesn't put their name or logo on their work is not proud of their work. It actually comes to, in my opinion, it's most people put out some pride with their work. But number one issue, I think, is that most people are so focused on the gear.
Yes.
Okay, Facebook, okay, the lighting, this and that, which are essential, but business part of it and the branding is left out. I think it has a lot to do with sitting down and studying, learning more about what is branding, what is marketing, what is this, what is that. I mean, people need to spend more time on that. And right. I think that will help. I think that will help. It's not. I mean, I can put 100 photographers, okay, and say 90 of them do not put any of any signature or information on their.
They just
work.
Don't have a plan, okay? Even. Yeah.
The thing is, I think most of them are either confused or not exactly know where they are with branding.
They don't know what they can do and what's okay and what they should do and all that kind of stuff. And this is a process. Barry, you were going to say mm-hmm. something. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, then you've got on the wedding side of things, you certainly aren't going to be signing every print and every page of every album.
I had a question about that. I mean, would you do that for every wedding? Because that's what I mainly do is wedding and portraits. So you would do that for your large signatures with weddings?
Here's what I'll do. Every album, every large print has to be signed. As I said earlier, 8x10 is the wallet for me, okay?
Right.
So no wallets, no 5x7s. No. No need for that, okay? We try to sell a separate album for each bridesmaid, for God's sake. Okay? So that's how we try to push this. Here's the thing. If the market is coming on me, okay, everybody's asking, when am I going to see my pictures on Facebook? Are you kidding me? I don't have to buy that. I don't have to take that. You know the saying, the best defense is offense? Okay? If you're coming to me and asking me, am I going to have my pictures on Facebook? Yeah, you will. But on the other hand, I'm gonna try to sell you this, try to sell you that. And if anything is going on a wall, or if anything is going on a nice coffee table that's going to be preserved for the generations, it has to be signed.
Sure, okay, absolutely.
Before we move on, Radar7792 from the chat was asking if someone might sign the mat instead of the print.
Well, Ansel Adams would a lot of times. He would, if you notice, a lot of his signatures were below the print. And this is something I considered really heavily. How do I want to handle this with my own work? Because there is that theory. Here's the thing. If from what I've seen, if you look at like an Ansel print where he signed underneath the image, it was a nice presentation. Those prints were also, the print was part of that mat. So it wasn't like he just signed the mat and it was a separate piece. From what I've seen looking at this, is that the image was mounted with space around it, and then he signed the open white space. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like, hey, I'll do a mat and then sign the mat. My issue with that, I don't have a problem with the way he did it. I do have a problem with only signing the mat, because the mat is not the image. The mat could be separated, replaced, you know, all that kind of stuff. So while I'm not going to say it's a wrong way to do it, personally, I wouldn't want to sign a separate mat. But if I had a space around the image, I think that would be perfectly relevant.
Right. I'm sorry. That's a really good question, because right now where I'm at in my business is I'm doing a low enough volume, like Barry, obviously, that I can take the time to make sure to frame and mat every print that goes out on the house. That's where I'm at now. That's how I want to be doing the business. So that's a good thing for me to know whether to sign the print or not. But I want it framed, printed, matted, all that stuff right out from the
house. Here's the problem with signing the mat is now you kind of lock yourself into always doing a mat. Because, you know, see how much we're discussing, we're debating, we're looking at these different options. Look at when you start thinking about this, how complex it actually is. I've literally spent years, you know, these things that I just rattled off for how I do it, it's been years of me like, okay, how do I do it? Finally nailing down to a consistency. So, and that's one of the reasons that I'm putting more articles and stuff, and I'm working on a series on this presentation stuff for how I do it. Not that that's how you'll do it or you'll do it or you'll do it. The point is, how do you want to do it? And once you do that, branding is in part at least consistency. It's about you build a reputation for this is the product Gavin makes. This is the product Jason or Barry or Gokhan makes. This is what this guy does. That doesn't mean you can't have more than one product. But my brand that I'm trying to build is, you know, Gavin does prints this way. They have this look. And you can't be everything. I see this all the time among photographers, not only in the way they make their photos, but in the way they brand. It's like, well, I do everything and I do it all different ways. You know, here's the selective color version. Here's the black and white version. Here's the regular version. It doesn't work that way. If you're going to be a master craftsman at something, you have to show that you're actually a master craftsman, that you understand the process that you're going through and what you're trying to make, how you're going to make it, how it's going to look, and that you can consistently produce those results in a way that not only looks good, but that they believe looks good because they see that you believe in that process and are willing to put your name behind it.
Yep.
Okay, we've covered this really well. Let's go in. It's getting late. I know we kind of went on this, but we need to talk about presentation more. This has been a really cool topic, and we've got some different approaches. Barry, are you glaring at me?
Nope.
And the point is, I think that, you know, just think about it, and let's talk about this more. We're going to come back to this in the future, because I want us all to go out and consider this, you know, what do we want to do, and then come back, you know, a year from now and say, all right, here's where I've started going. We've gotten into the rut of just taking whatever is currently available at the lab. This is why I love printing for myself, because there's so much more variables. But maybe you can't do that today. But that doesn't mean you can't go out and say, okay, what do I want to sell? You know, I really don't want to show people the canvas wrap and the non-canvas wrap and the wood wrap and the flush mount and the float mount and the cardboard wrap and the plastic wrap and the underpants. I mean, it's where does it end? We need to decide what we want to sell and how we want to sell it. That's my thought on presentation. Thank you, guys. Okay. Lest I get chastised later for talking too much, do you guys want to do a little lightning round? And then it's getting late here, so we can't go too long. We did a lot of time on presentation. Let's do a metered lightning round where we have limits. See what happens, Barry, when we have a discussion with no limits. This is why Barry invented the lightning round.
This presentation discussion, it's just such a circular discussion because there's so many aspects to it. So,
well, there's so many aspects to it, but every time we look at a different aspect, it gets us thinking about different things. So I don't think that's a true negative.
All right, what's the lightning round and how fast can we do it?
Let's see. I've got a few of them. I think one of these was recommended by Jason. One of them is workflow and sales. I think that's a bit of a long one for a quickie.
I think so too, yeah.
This has come up a couple times. Let's do a lightning round on this, and that is, should photographers have to be licensed? Yes or no? And if so, how would that work? I have, you know, I've voiced my opinions on this before, but people always ask, like, well, what about this? And I get this question. Let's put it to a lightning round and have everybody give their opinions, and let's limit this. Let's give everybody 2 minutes, and I'm going to bring up the stopwatch here so we don't
go on forever.
Everybody's got to... put this. Does this sound like a good topic?
Before you explain what you mean by licensed.
What I mean by licensed is, for example, I grew up in the building industry. In the building industry, a contractor has to be licensed and bonded. They have to have a license from the state, as it were, and that's how it has to operate in this business. So the guy comes around, if you're, you know, working on somebody's house and they say, well, let's see your license. And if you don't have a license, you get a big fine, and that's licensing. So effectively it's the state mandating that you have to be approved by the state to occupy and work in a certain industry. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to give 2 minutes to everybody. Who wants to go first in this?
Jason, you go first this time.
Hang on. Let me. I'll tell you when the timer. When you hear the gong, when you hear the ding, we have an official bell this time. When you hear the ding, you can start.
All right. So, great. In my day job, I work as a nuclear analyst, and the nuclear industry is extremely regulated. And I can tell you from personal experience, I think it's a very bad idea. I think it's up to the customers and the photographer themselves to present themselves well. The customer needs to know what they're buying. They need to be able to see the photographer's work, go to their website, talk to them, see their portfolio, see examples of the images. But I don't see why licensing would need to come into play at all on this. That's really all I've got.
Any no more in-depth thoughts as to, do you have a reason why you don't think licensing would work, I guess, let's, since you got a couple a minute left?
Well, I think simply because, you know, you might have a licensed contractor, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be a great contractor. You know, I've had people that are licensed build parts of the house that seem to want to fall apart, you know, replace the roof and it leaks more when they're finished and they're licensed. So it really, it doesn't matter if they're licensed or not. It matters what kind of work that they're producing.
Okay. Awesome. And, it's, do you succeed your time?
Yes.
Okay.
But not to Gavin.
Ouch.
Nice.
You've been talking to Barry, I think. Okay. Who wants to go next? Barry, you want to go?
Sure.
Okay, on the bell, and
go. I started my timer as well. Absolutely not. I think that I'm not a fan of regulating anything. Regulation, just the complexities are endless. The gatekeeper, who's to say what qualifies, and who's there to police to the customers that, oh, I'm sorry, you can't hire a photographer who's not regulated, who's not, you know, certified, who's not licensed. That's crazy. A 12-year-old with a camera can take a pretty nice picture nowadays because of the automation of cameras. And what are we going to do? Have the police come driving down the street and arrest the 12-year-old for taking a picture of the neighbor's cat because they're not a licensed photographer? This is a creative field. It is a hobby that can turn into a profession. It is a profession that often gets blurred as a hobby, and it's a profession who the gates have been blown apart because technology has made it so easy for everybody to be a photographer already. If all of a sudden the industry came out with this, oh, you have to be licensed to be a photographer, I think we would be, those of us who were already existing professionals, we would be looked at as the villains of society trying to prevent people from, you know, these creative outlets. So I am going to just stand on an absolute no. Let's hope that our work and our reputation and our experience and our professionalism and ultimately that, I don't need that. So nope, done. I defer my time to Gokin. By the way, Gokin, you do need to do a music video and go Gokin style for your wedding.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Okay.
Actually, Gokin. there is a YouTube video. While I was waiting for the bridal party to do something, the bridesmaids started dancing. Go Gokin. Nice. It was so funny. So the videographer grabbed that and then we put it on YouTube somewhere. Anyway, on regulation.
2 minutes.
All right. I'll try to stop at 2 minutes, okay?
Well, they give you a couple seconds extra.
So. All right, good. On a regulation, I am with Barry. I am not for regulating, but even though I'm not going to try to turn this into a political debate, I'm not for small government. I'm not for big government. I'm for efficient and transparent government. So same thing applies to photography here. Photography is an art form. It's not a sport, okay? You cannot time it. Like licensing can be, you know, people can think about two things. What are you going to license photographers for if they know which aperture is a smaller opening, f/22 or f/2? Are you going to ask that and question them and then license them? Or try to license people on how they operate business. In my opinion, I think if you open the subject and go deeper, I think there is a room to a bigger discussion on what should be regulated, if anything needs to be regulated, because of digital. As you know, we all make less money than 10 years ago because of the heavily saturated market. So, okay, I think people who charge money for taking pictures should be regulated on their taxes. Okay? So I think even though this was an unexpected question, and I'm just thinking loud here, we could discuss if people should be forced to have business insurance if they are charging money to photograph somebody's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am not suggesting that as of now, but I think this can be and this should be discussed. A lot of times people do talk about getting a certification from PPA. Unfortunately, there's no gray there. People either very against it or totally for it. All right. I mean, there will be pros and cons of having a certification from PPA, but I think it's an art form. You cannot tell people to not take pictures or take pictures at certain angle or with certain lighting technique. You can't do that. You cannot license people that way. But I think for the business standpoint, there should be a little bit more regulations. For example, we have a wonderful system called welfare, right? You know, I'm not going to go in there, but it was found on helping the needy, okay? And now when you see your tax money going somewhere that's not – ah, come on now.
Wrap it up. You got 15 all right. seconds.
So I think it should be talked about. And on the business side, there should be a little bit more regulations, a little bit more.
Sure. Okay.
So that will force people to take it a little bit more serious.
Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Gokhan. And I will wrap it up. Barry's probably going to be watching my time, but I'm going to be pretty restrictive on myself. And
ready?
I'll be watching you.
We ready? Okay.
You already started.
Hey, the bell just rang. Okay. If I can't make it in business, I don't deserve to be there. And I don't need the government to protect my industry. I'm not looking to force people to buy my product my way. I want to make them want my product. Licensing, and I've seen this, you know, growing up in the business I grew up in the contracting industry, and if you're an electrician, that kind of stuff, there's rules about having to be licensed. But licensing means nothing to consumer value or quality, and in no way guarantees happiness of the client. No state is going to actually take the time to make sure quality is being produced, only to gain revenue and more control over people. It's just about a way to make money. So people come to me, and they say, well, the industry is having a hard time, and there needs to be some regulation. We can't have everybody taking photos. Yes, we can. I say capitalism and free markets work. And I say that if I want somebody to buy my product, I have to show them the value. I'm not looking to, you know, force somebody to buy what I have versus what the other guy has. Licensing will in no way improve photography. Just frankly, like most government involvement, causes nothing but a disruption of freedom and quality. And I take the conservative approach, and yet the whole panel, in some way or another, it seems to be in agreement, which frankly kind of surprises me. I just want less government across the board. But the bottom line is, I don't see anything the government could do improving photography in any way whatsoever. Anything they would come up with would just be about them making revenue on licensing. I want the industry to improve, and I want the bar to be raised, but I don't see the government doing it, because if the government can't even raise the bar on themselves, if the government can't even operate competently in their own business, U.S. Postal Service, if the government can't even operate a business, why should I expect them to be able to run mine? That's my thoughts.
Wow, 2 minutes right on. Wow. Impressive. Rare.
Okay, that was good. You know what? We covered this topic. I'll be honest, you know, and we can take, you know, 2 minutes just to, if anybody wants any final recaps, but that was interesting. Honestly, I didn't expect the whole panel to agree. The people out there that disagree with me on this probably are thinking, I just want to say that I didn't cherry pick this panel to only find people that agree with me on this.
All right. The one thing though that I would like to stress, and Gokhan, I think touched on it just briefly, is I am appalled by how many photographers I am aware of in my market who are doing weddings in most cases who are not charging, collecting, or paying sales tax. Mm-hmm. And that is, it infuriates me. I had a state sales tax audit a year ago, and I actually they never even got into the audit because we talked about all this stuff, and the auditor left and said, "You're fine. I'm going to go through some things with you." but I asked that question. I said, rather than me wasting all this time in this witch hunt, here it is. It's very transparent. Here's what we do. It's all right here. I said, go on to Craigslist and see how many people are shooting weddings now in the Twin Cities. And I guarantee you, probably not one of them has a sales tax ID number. And if you want to go find free money, it's mm-hmm. all over the place. That's what annoys me. Conducting business lawfully by all the rules and all the regulations and the taxes, it's really not a fair playing field for people to think that, oh, I can just charge somebody $1,500 and because it's a service, I don't have to charge them sales tax. Or worse yet, I'll charge them sales tax and make the extra $150 or $200 and never pay it to the state because I don't have to because I'm not a business.
So it annoys you not so much because you like the regulation and the taxes and all that kind of stuff, but because if you have to pay it, you feel there needs to be a level playing field in a business.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that they're cheating the system, they're cheating the state, and they're not acting professionally. You know, business insurance is one thing. You know, I carry obviously a significant liability rider. So mm-hmm. if I'm in a balcony of a church and I knock my lens off the balcony and it knocks Ann
Edmund. Or if it falls off the front of your camera.
But that's a good point. Yeah, you can guys have to walk around with nets underneath you, I realize. But those are serious things to be in consideration of if you're going to. Yeah.
Right.
You're going to wear your big boy pants and do this for real.
Yeah, also you can look at this in a way of protecting the consumer. Now, Gavin, you might just say, why do I need a government to protect me? But then why do I need the armed forces, or why do I need the cops or the fire department? At some point, again, as I said earlier, I'm not for big government or small government. Either one of them can go wrong. But
at that point, I would, as an American, refer you to my constitution.
at some point, well, the constitution though, anyway, let's not go there.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. And I know we could make a whole show about this stuff, and mm-hmm. I'm not against sitting and dialoguing about this.
Yeah.
But we probably shouldn't turn this. If we turn into a show about how Gavin feels about the current level of politics, I'll probably make some
people. No. Let's not go into politics or religion. But I think there is a little bit of room for a certain amount of regulation and having, like, okay, Gavin Syme, you go out and shoot weddings, okay? And you charge money for this. Okay, let's have you purchase a business insurance. And let me make sure you're paying your taxes.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I disagree, mm-hmm. and I realize, you know, that's okay. I mean, I don't think that there should be any requirements of whether, you know, if I want to have insurance, nobody should be forcing me to support an insurance company. I do have some business insurance. I'm not a big fan of insurance, mm-hmm. but I should not be forced to buy a product from somebody else. I can take personal responsibility for myself, and that's what I want mm-hmm. to do. I think it's ludicrous that I have to buy a business license. I think it's crazy that I would have to buy insurance. I think any of those kind of regulations are inappropriate for the government to be involved in. Now, taxes are a different, you know, different topic, and we won't go down that road. And I do pay sales tax and stuff like that, of course. I mean, I run a business. I have frustrations with taxes. I don't have a complete disagreement with the principle of taxes, but I do have an issue with, you know, where all that money's spent. But anyway, that's another topic. Jason, do you have any closing thoughts here?
No, I think we've pretty well beat this one pretty good. Yeah.
We've done it good, but we did it pretty quick. And, no, that was cool. Hey, real quick, and then we'll go into picks of the week, guys. I don't think we're going to have too much time for another lightning round, but we've had some good topics today. I do want to shout out to my kids who are watching at home. Anna's birthday, I think, is coming up in 2 days now. I should know exactly, but hello to Anna and Cyrus and Asher and my lovely wife, Sandra, who's watching at home on this live show.
Happy birthday, Anna.
Yes, indeed, little girl. She's going to be 3. Okay. So with that, let's kind of wrap this up. I was going to throw in a little ad, but I'll just do that at the end because I've got a few things to plug and I'm sure you guys do too. So we'll do that after our picks of the week and stick around and listen to what we got going on. We've got some neat projects happening. So anyways, let's jump into picks of the week and then send everybody home and let's go home and have a nice Thanksgiving and a good weekend and go from there. And pretty soon it's going to be a new year, which is scary, and we'll see what happens in 2013. So who wants to go first with this week's POTWs?
Go, Barry.
My pick of the week is a service.
That was the wrong button. Sorry,
you know,
Greg.
People wonder why these crazy shows go for 12 hours.
I thought I was clicking the crickets button and because it said silence, and instead it said,
I kill you.
Okay, Barry, go with your pick.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Jeff Dunham is awesome. I'm just not going to say. So, now my pick of the week is a product called Sticky Albums.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's
Gavin actually kind of got me connected up with these folks. I'm just in the preliminary process of beginning to work with them a little bit. It is a very clever software solution that allows a photographer to, in essence, create an app for your customers so that their gallery of images can be basically ported right onto their phone with a link that gets sent to them. It loads on their phone and looks kind of like an app. It functions like an app. It has a button, customized button on the home screen, allows you as a photographer to brand it, to coupon it, to do whatever you want to do with it.
Right.
I'm looking at using it as probably an upsell type of an item, something that is only included with my higher-end session offerings. I'm not sure if it has an application with weddings or not, but the potential is significant, and I'm kind of excited about some of the work I'm doing so far.
Nice. Very cool. I will link that. In fact, I'm glad you bring that up because I haven't got a chance to look at it real close, but it looked interesting. I know you were kind of excited about it. And I think Dennis might have looked at it too. So maybe this is something as you use it more and actually work with it, we can bring it up on the show and get into a little more detail and a little more of a quick review on it. But for now, go check it out because it does seem like they have an interesting product. Very cool. GoCon, do you have a pick of the week for us this week?
I have a pick of the month.
Well, yeah, that's probably a pick. That's probably more accurate, but fine. Okay. Fine. Go ahead.
All right. I recently got my new iPhone.
Uh-huh.
And thank you very much. I brought that up because it really is the best iPhone they made so far. I was pretty happy with the last one, the 4S, but the speed of the server and the phone was an issue. And as soon as I switched to Verizon and a new phone with new processor, it's very, very dramatically faster. Yeah, it's that's my pick. It's a good investment. Yep.
Okay, but that's a cheater pick because everybody knows about the iPhone. You got to give us some super secret like thing.
Secret. I've been spending my time on editing and talking to Bright, so I haven't.
You don't have any super.
See, GoCon, working photographers, Gavin has a hard time understanding us because we're so busy doing work all the time.
Hey, I work very hard. I just spend a lot of the time researching and experimenting and tinkering over here.
We're dealing with people all day long, so it's a little different deal.
I come into work.
Pick, GoCon.
Yeah, that's cool. I come into work and it's. Well, that's work. Yeah, there's that. It's an adventure.
Go brew some coffee. All right, Jason, what do you got?
Okay, go, Jason. It's like go.
All right,
con,
for those who can see this, I have something. It's called a Foursquare from Lightwear Direct, and the concept is simple. You've got four spots on it that you can mount a speed light, or you can mount pocket wizards with speed lights on them. And then you can put an umbrella, or they make them with softboxes, which is what I use them with. So you can put four flashes inside a softbox with a remote trigger, and then you can give it to a voice-activated light stand like my wife, who for weddings can run around, and now you've got a nice, big, beautiful softbox for all of your photos, and you've got enough power to overpower the sun if you need to, or to keep the flashes recycling really fast. So that you don't have to wait on them, they don't overheat. It's just it's a pretty neat item. Lightwear Direct Foursquare.
Nice. And, how much is that going for?
Yeah, what's that going for?
That's 109, I think, for the bracket. But you can spend $300 if you want to get the big soft box, 30-inch soft box, I think.
Okay.
Also
cool.
Comes with it, and they have holes in each corner, and that's how the soft box mounts. So you can mount it to any stand or any monopod or however you want to do it.
So it's pretty versatile then.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I had trouble when I did some weddings of taking photos, and the flash would overheat. I'd have to change flashes, or I'd be outside, and I couldn't overpower the sun with what I had. So this was a great solution, $109, and I just attached it, add four lights, and you're good to go.
Very cool. Very cool.
I do have one more real fast. Amazon has Lightroom 4 for $109 for the next... I'd say next few days. So if you don't have Lightroom or you're considering it, now's the time.
Lightroom 4 for $109. That's a good deal for Lightroom 4. That's a very good deal.
That's the full version. That's correct.
That's great. Okay, cool. Okay, well, I will cast out a couple of picks there of the old week, and I'm just grabbing real quick. My first pick is, I'm going to put it in the chat room over here. Is on Amazon, and it's Harbio Gummy Candy Frogs. Do not laugh. These are awesome. Okay. Has anyone here ever had Harbio Frogs?
No.
Barry, come on. You've had Harbio Frogs, right?
Nope.
Seriously? Okay. Harbio Frogs are the best gummy candy you've ever had. They're kind of a lime gummy candy. This is not a joke. This is very serious stuff. I like snacks. The cool thing is you can buy these. They're pretty inexpensive. They're kind of a lime gummy candy, and then on the underside, they kind of have a soft underbelly that's not a marshmallow, but it's a little squishy, okay? These are great to have, like, you know, around the studio or something like that. They're just a really good munchie. You can buy them in bulk or by individual bags. They are delicious. You can get 12 5-ounce bags for $14, which means they're cheap. And I have yet... Well, I don't know if I found a person that doesn't like Harbio Frogs. Maybe my one-year-old. I'm not sure he's into them yet. He will be in time, but that is worth looking at. Check out Harbio Frogs. Buy a box. Trust me. Harbio Frogs rock. Your wife will thank you. Your kids will thank you. Your clients will thank you. Okay? That's my first pick.
Okay.
My second pick is MailChimp. MailChimp is very cool. Most of you probably are familiar with MailChimp, but the reason I wanted to make it a pick this week is on the note of content freedom and building lists and getting back to the basics of the newsletter. We didn't get into this topic too deep today, but those of you that follow me know that a while back I posted a portrait of my kids in the bathtub. It didn't show anything. I'll link it in the show notes. It's called The Bath. No nudity was in it, and Facebook blocked me. Facebook took the photo off and banned me for 24 hours for posting this photo. So it got me thinking, you know, first of all, yes, Facebook's kind of starting to charge and all this stuff. And I got an article, some articles coming out on Pro Photo Show in the next week or so, kind of related to these topics and building lists and newsletters and some things I've kind of learned going through this. But the bottom line is here, Facebook essentially owns us when we're on Facebook. You know, we've come to rely on Facebook so much in terms of, you know, even if we make a blog post, the links are on Facebook, all this kind of stuff. In a way, I think the fact that Facebook pages are becoming pay to play, I mean, i.e. most of your fans aren't even seeing it now unless you pay for to promote the post. In a way, that's a good thing because it's made me think more about how we can generate traffic to our own sites and our own content that we control, not some corporate entity, and have better control over that. So with that, I went out and I built a new, brand new newsletter. I've had newsletters before, and SimFX has a newsletter, but I said, I got to build a newsletter again for my studio and my work and my photography that's kind of my personal newsletter that I've kind of let go because I had one years ago. So I went back. I completely flushed the other one. I sent one final newsletter to the people that subscribed to the old newsletter, which was never that big. And I said, okay, here is my new newsletter I'm doing called The Light Letter. Subscribe to it if you're interested. Otherwise, this is the last email you'll receive on this. So I didn't just add everybody. And I've been promoting this newsletter called The Light Letter. I made it its own website, and I kind of gave it a brand. It's related to my projects, but I tried to make it something significant. And it's not just my photo newsletter. It's a newsletter that talks about, you know, yes, what I'm working on with photography, but there's all these little tidbits. There's links to interesting stuff. There's looking at art and photo history. So what I did is I said, how can I make something in a newsletter that has value for people and then get it out there? Because once you build a list, a quality list,
I control that content. MailChimp, coming back to the pick of the week, is just a really good service. They're actually free, I think, up to like 1,000 contacts or something, which is really phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I have a lot more than that now between my various lists, but they've got good interfaces for building emails. I mean, if you're going to do a newsletter, make it pretty, make it nice, build content for people that are truly interested. And gosh, I mean, since I did the light letter and really kind of focused on, okay, it's going to have a page, I'm going to make pretty sign-up forms on my sites, I've built that list. It's over 600 now, and it came out about a month ago. And we're talking about not me adding customers to the list, but double opt-in quality subscribers. I sent the first one about a week ago, and it got a 66% open rate, and I think about a 30% click rate, which is very, you know, way higher than industry average in terms of sending out a newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
So the point being, MailChimp is just a good tool to do to work with this. I'll link it in the show notes, and you can check it out. But bottom line is, think about this. And on that note, I mean, you know, go over to lightletter.com and you can check out what I'm doing there. I also put a page there about content freedom. I just posted an article about this today on Facebook called A Facebook Spanking and How It Affects Your Business. But the dialogue I'm trying to open here is, you know, let's think about ways that we can free up our content. And we'll come back to this on a future episode. I just wanted to toss it out because Harbio frogs are great. And MailChimp has been a really good company to work with. It's pretty classy. It's quality content that you can produce.
Gavin, is their unsubscribe feature pretty robust?
Absolutely. And if you get my newsletter, on all my newsletters, you can unsubscribe with, I think it's a single click. And I don't hide that. You know, I get newsletters all the time and I'm hunting through looking for the unsubscribe. I do not want to pay to send people emails that don't want them. I want people reading my content that want my content. And if you get my newsletter at the very top, if you get a newsletter and you say, this is crap, why did I subscribe to this? It takes you seconds to unsubscribe. So yes, I mean, you can place that link wherever you want, but they're absolutely, MailChimp is pretty rigid about, you better have a legit list. You know, this better not be something you copied from the Chamber of Commerce website. You better have unsubscribe links, all your contact info. You know, this is not a spam service. This is for people who want to build legitimate lists and produce legitimate content. And I'm not new to newsletters. I've been doing a newsletter for SimeFX customers for a long time, but the light letter has been an interesting project because it's more of a personal project. And it really, what I've seen on Facebook in terms of not only censorship, but just the fact of how much you have to pay to get content out there. I've paid as much as $300 to promote a post. And admittedly, I'm not saying I didn't get any returns from that, but I want to have my content in my control. So in long way around, MailChimp.com, check out their product. It's good. And it's, as I understand it, it's been ages since I signed up, but they have a free service, I believe. And I'll try and find some links for you guys.
Yeah, it is. I believe 1,000 contacts is correct because I've worked with MailChimp. I've also worked with Direct Mail, is another, and I've actually worked with that long before I found MailChimp.
Right.
And one of the challenges I'm trying to figure out is how I can, because I have multiple mailing lists or email lists already established by customer and category, that I have a million unsubscribes already, you know, unsubscribed to those. So I'm trying to kind of figure out how I could maybe slide those into MailChimp, preserve the unsubscribed.
You just download the current list of active subscribers and only import those?
Well, yes, but the problem is I have to be really careful because a lot of those are multiple emails across. I have the same customers giving me the email from potentially five different lists typically.
Yeah.
So I have to really be careful that I cross-reference. Again, I deal with thousands and thousands of customers every year, so it's a whole different animal to manage.
Well, and you got a huge potential there for building a great list, but definitely, I mean, you'd have to filter down. I'm glad I only have, I have two lists, so I have SimeFX and then I have LightLetter.
The other thing for anybody looking at MailChimp, you have to understand what your own ISP's server, host server's limitations are and how many emails can go out through your email.
No, they're not going out through your email. MailChimp is sending these out.
But isn't it tied to your POP email account?
No, it's tied to it in that that's the reply to address, and that's the account that's accountable for where the emails are coming from. So they can, you know, they can respond to you and say, why the heck are you sending me this? But it's not your server that's sending out. MailChimp manages the mail going out.
That's the way direct mail works. You can use either your SMTP server.
Okay.
And at which point you can only send 200 a day or 400.
Right. No, that's not how. And I don't know if you can do that on MailChimp.
Or you can pay a very nominal fee to buy credits and then pop it through their server and then it goes instantly.
Yeah, the
and
way
I
MailChimp
actually found with MailChimp, I've used MailChimp. successfully with some new lists. I'm not wild about the MailChimp interface. It takes me way too long to build it. It's much faster in direct mail, but...
But I like that they got a new editor now that's actually a drag and drop editor that's really elegant. And if the latest edition of the Light Letter I used it for, and it was pretty cool. It's got a few bugs. But the bottom line is, I mean, I can go in there, build a newsletter. In no other way without paying can I go in. And I mean, I pay because I subscribe to MailChimp. I have an account that's a monthly account, or you can buy credits. But the bottom line is I can go out and build a newsletter, and I can I can send a newsletter out in 5 minutes to 5,000 people. Now, I'm conservative with this. I mean, I send my newsletter for SimFX like once a month. So I want to respect people's email. But anyways, something to look at, something to think about, and something we'll talk about more, kind of a pick of the week turning into something long. But let's wrap it up for the night. And I think GoCon has to get going here. And this has been a good show. Let's kind of go through, everybody give kind of their plugs and let us know what you're currently working on, and we'll go from there. We'll start with me. You can find me, of course, Seim Studios, SEIMstudios.com, and that includes my newsletter, all my projects, Pro Photo Show, SimFX, in particular, new products. Of course, if you haven't seen my new Exposed workshop, check that out. I think it'll blow you away. I also did an update this week, the brand new HDR Magic and Beyond Workshop version 1.5, new videos, new content added, and it's not just the tone map HDR, it's a workshop of getting in and editing and working with and understanding dynamic range, everything from, you know, looking at your histogram to tone mapping to working with layers. So if you want to better control your dynamic range, check out HDR Magic. That's at simfx.com/HDR. And of course, all the presets for Lightroom and the tools for Aperture and Photoshop and stuff like that are over there as well. And of course, all the Lightroom stuff is now fully Lightroom 4 compatible, and some cool stuff over there. So that is my little ad for you for this week. Helps keep us going around here. And with that, let's kind of go through the panel. Barry, thank you for joining us. It's been great to have you sitting. Sometimes the problem with video is sometimes I feel you're looking at me and being like, man, Gavin, you're so immature. But I try.
Well, you are, but you know.
I try. See, look at this. You see this? You see this? I'm sitting over here. I'm thinking what people are thinking of me is... And Barry's Barry's over there looking at me as if I'm some sort of a, you know, just like, so I'm just saying. Anyway, Barry, sorry, I've been having fun with the sound effects. We'll taper this off gradually. All right, Barry, where can they find you? Thank you for joining us. What do you have to plug this week?
Just pictureplace.com. I'd encourage you just to click on my blog link right off the homepage.
Awesome.
I've been a fairly regular blogger. I blogged my second most popular blog this last week. The title was My First iPhone Wedding. So they had a good response, and it was a good read. Yeah, that got a lot of good. Blog post just before that was our kind of talking a little bit about our North Shore experience. So that was kind of fun too. But check it out. And meanwhile, you'll find me shooting a session or chasing a senior around or doing something, because that's kind of what I do all day.
Barry does more sessions in a week than most of us put together do in a year, I think. But that's just his style.
I'd just like to get the wedding category pumped back up. I might have to get GoCon up here and get some private consulting here.
I'd like to get every category pumped up, to be honest. We'll see what happens next year. GoCon.
I definitely would love to meet with you in person when I'm in Minnesota next time. Definitely.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for joining us, GoCon. It's always fun to have you on. And where can people find you and your projects? Do you have anything to plug?
Anything to plug? Well, actually, many things to plug, to be honest with you. But my wedding website is gokanweddings.com. It's GOKHAN weddings.com. My blog is photographersdaily.net, which is a blog that I share whatever I find interesting on the internet. And just awesome. It's very active there. And as you already know, and become a good part and a contributor of the Chicago Photographic Society. It's a Facebook group that I started 4 years ago. Now became a nonprofit organization with more than 1,500 members all around the world. We're just running a wonderful street photography contest with world-renowned judges.
Cool.
So entries and everything is on our official website, chicagophotographicsociety.org. Everything can be found there. And thank you for inviting me again.
Yeah.
And it was a pleasure. You.
Very
it
cool.
It was a pleasure.
And with that, let's go to Jason. I'm not suggesting you're a psycho. I'm just, I had to click that button.
No, it's just the name. It's just in the name.
Thank you for joining us, Jason. It's been fun to have you. It's always fun to chat with you. And I think I'm sensing a little bit of shock because we're so like, you know, we get going and talking and Jason's just like, I can't get a word in edgewise around these people. I'm just sitting here, you know, wanting to like hit the gong or something and tell them to shut up. But thank you for joining us and hope to have you back sometime.
I've enjoyed it. I'd love to come back anytime.
And where can they find you? I know that you've had some cool projects going. In fact, you had a book come out recently, didn't you? Give people a shout out about that. I know you had a great little book that I saw kind of before it came out and looked at and some great stuff in there on exposure.
Yeah, you can find me at eldrestudios.com. You can find all of my information there. I've got a blog that I update very regularly. I have, you can find me on Facebook there, and you can find a link to the book, which is Understanding the Basics of Exposure. And I wrote that initially because when I first started in photography, was back in the film days, and a lot of people were very secret about what exposure was and how it really worked. And
right.
And so I didn't want anyone to go through what I did to try to figure it out in the very beginning. So awesome. I wrote a little book. It's specifically for the iPad, but you can get it in PDF. And all it does is detail the very basics of exposure, what ISO is, shutter speed, aperture, all of that. And it's, like I say, just a little 33-page book, $2.99. You can find the link on my website, Understanding the Basics. You can go on my blog, and I've got an excerpt for one of the chapters there. You can read it and see what you think.
No, I mean,
and
definitely.
If I'm not mistaken, do what?
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I said, if I'm not mistaken, Gavin, I think you wrote the foreword.
I did write the foreword because it's that good. I generally, this is really cool. What I loved about this book that Jason put together is it's simple, it's short. You know, this isn't a big, long photo book, nor is it a real expensive photo book. It's one of those things that even if you're experienced, you'll sit down and kind of browse through and it just kind of reinforce some things. But especially if you're newer to photography, you know, if you've just started in the past few years, and I we're in an industry right now where a lot of times the industry spends more time talking about how to use software and fix photos than how to just make them right in the first place. So this is a great little book just to go through and make sure your understanding of exposure is, you know, founded and that you got a solid grasp. And a perfect extension of that to make this, you know, completely shameless self-promotion. After you read Jason's book, go check out the Expose Workshop because it just takes that even further and deeper. Jason, no, you did a really good job on it. It's really cool. Again, how do they spell your site? It's ELDRIDGE studios.com, I believe it is.
That's correct.
Got it.
And the direct link to the blog is elderstudios.blogspot.com, but you can get there from my main website.
Very cool. Well, we'll link all this stuff in the show notes, guys. Everybody, I appreciate you joining us. It's been a good show. We've got some good topics. Thank you to all of those of you who joined in to the live stream and who gave input. I know some of you were shouting out, giving us links and things like that. Appreciate you guys being here. And so far, it seems like this live show actually went down pretty good, so we may continue this. Mm-hmm. Personally, my favorite part was the fact that I had sound effects. And I just, you know, Barry, you suggested years ago, or maybe it was Dennis, that we should have sound effects. Now there's an official soundboard because it's cool. So thank you all. This has been Pro Photo Show. Find the show notes and everything at profotoshow.net. And we will see you all next time. You all have a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you very soon. With
happy that, Thanksgiving.
Sounds great. Thanks. Sounds good. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Yep.
See ya. Gokhan, I think, had to take off here. Just real quick, let's just go through, now that we're an after show, let's see what all the sound effects are. We got applause.
Yes, I kill you.
That one's good. That one's good. I'm going to use that one on Dennis. Oh, the boo one. I should have used that more. The boxing bell. That's what we use. Oh, that's kind of crude. The burp.
So have you guys both seen Skyfall?
Is that the new James Bond movie? I've only seen like one James Bond movie in my entire life. Was it actually good?
No, wow. I haven't seen Skyfall. I've seen the one right before it. Preparing to go see it.
Was it good?
We're going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't better than Exposed, was it? I guess it's a different target market. Barry's just looking at me like, what is wrong with you?
Okay. Is there any way to disable the sound effects? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I think that, no, I don't believe there is. That's why I have the sound effect. Actually, I think you guys have a soundboard too. Ooh, that's good.
Gavin, you already know that Facebook can ban you. You're just tempting Google.
I'm tempting Google Plus. It's like banned for overuse of the.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's actually snoring.
Yeah.
Well, that's the intercom. It's like Star Trek.
Uh-oh.
Okay, let's see if we can get this right. Hang on. I got this. Scotty, two to beam up. Okay, that's going
to
get
ready. Tell you what, you guys can enjoy this. I actually have to get a little work done tonight before I call this a holiday. So.
Okay, yes, it is one of those short weeks that I'm going to have to wrap up here soon. As soon as I get through all the sound effects. Thank you, Barry, for joining us. We'll talk to you soon. It's been a good show.
Thanks, Barry. It's good talking to you.
Yep, we'll see you again.
Take care, Barry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ooh, I need that one. Of course, I could do that. Let me see if I bounce. Man, I'll practice that later. It'll be less embarrassing. Siren. Ooh, I like the squeaky toy. That's cool.